score.
Didst cry out unto... I say, what's the matter?
I was dreaming, I guess. What?
The following program is intended for listeners who are blind, have low vision, or have another print disability, which makes reading, holding a book, or turning a page difficult or impossible. The content is copyrighted by the respective publishers. For more information, please visit us on the web at nfradioreading.org.
Hello, this is Patricia, and for the next hour, I'll be reading from current issues of the Niagara Falls Review on the Niagara Frontier Radio Reading Service. The Niagara Frontier Review for October 23rd, from the front page. Province to appoint Bradley's replacement, by Bill Sawchuk. Ontario's Municipal Affairs and Housing Minister has informed Niagara Region that the provincial government will be appointing Jim Bradley's replacement as chair. A letter from Minister Robert Flack to Regional Clerk Anne-Marie Norio, dated October 17th and obtained by the Standard, expressed condolences on the September 26th death of Bradley and acknowledged his contributions and commitment to the region, its residents, and the province of Ontario. In light of the resulting vacancy, I am writing to advise Niagara Regional Council of my intention to make an order under Section 218.3 of the Municipal Act 2001 to appoint a new chair of Niagara Region to serve for the duration of the current term of council, Flack wrote in the letter delivered to the region Tuesday. I will share details about the appointee in the coming weeks once the appointment process is underway. The letter was circulated by email to councillors late Tuesday afternoon. It also said the province is committed to working collaboratively with the region and will be providing further details as it works to finalize the appointment. The province appointed Bradley to a second term as chair immediately after the 2022 municipal election, reasoning it needed a reliable partner at the head of council to help tackle Ontario's housing crisis. Bradley was first elected to the chair's position by his fellow councillors in 2018. Niagara Falls NDP MPP Wayne Gates on Wednesday called out the Doug Ford government for meddling again in Niagara's regional chair appointment and rewarding friends and failed conservative candidates and donors with other appointments while ignoring local decision-making. For years now, Doug Ford has treated Niagara like his personal appointment agency, stacking our boards with insiders and ignoring the voices of the people who live and work here, Gates said in the legislature. We have a series of failed candidates who all lost at the ballot box, but Ford handed them government jobs anyway. That's not democracy, that's cronyism. A staff message to councillors dated October 9th had stated the Municipal Affairs Ministry would provide official correspondence to council regarding the process of selecting a new chair before Thursday's full meeting. The Constitution establishes the municipalities are creatures of the province, which gives provincial governments almost unlimited authority to alter municipal functions, to set new boundaries, or even dissolve municipalities entirely, the message said. Council's procedural bylaw lays out a procedure whereby newly elected councillors vote to select someone for the position at the first meeting after municipal elections. An elected councillor has served as chair since the region was established in 1970. The province had several options to replace Bradley since his death. The ministry can appoint a sitting councillor or name a member of the public to serve as chair for the remainder of the term, which ends on October 26, 2026. The chair receives a salary of more than $140,000 and a vehicle allowance to represent the region in dealings with the federal, provincial, and other municipal governments. The chair also presides over meetings and is the primary public spokesperson for Niagara. Depending on the person, the individual can also wield considerable informal influence at regional headquarters in Thoreau. If the province selects a sitting councillor as chair, that person's municipality is responsible for choosing a replacement, either by appointment or by election, and notifying the region. Since Bradley's death, council has relied on a procedural bylaw that establishes an alphabetical rotation of councillors to serve as interim chair on a monthly basis. Welland County Pat Chicorio is the current interim chair. Continuing with the front page of the Niagara Falls Review for October 23rd, suspect in Brampton murder shot dead by Niagara police, by Ray Spiteri and Allison Langley. An officer-involved shooting in Niagara Falls has led to the death of a suspect who police say shot and killed a woman in Brampton and fled in a car with a one-year-old child. Officers with Niagara Regional Police and Peel Regional Police Service had been actively searching for a suspect wanted in connection with the homicide that occurred Tuesday afternoon in Brampton. An Amber Alert was subsequently issued for the missing child. Investigators had reason to believe the suspect, identified as 38-year-old Anthony DeShepper, was in the Niagara region. A shelter-in-place order was issued for the area of Crystal Beach and Fort Erie after evidence related to the police investigation was discovered. The child was located with a family member in Niagara at about 5 p.m., said NRP spokesperson Richard Hingley. At about 2:30 a.m. Wednesday, officers in Niagara Falls blocked in a vehicle at Gale's Gas Bar on Thoreau Road, Stone Road near Montrose Road. Following an interaction with NRP officers, the Ontario Special Investigations Unit said DeShepper was shot multiple times and died at the scene. SIU spokesperson Christy Danette said an unnamed female was in the driver's seat of the vehicle. She is in custody and charges are pending. No officers were injured. A large area at Thoreau Stone and Montrose Roads was closed to traffic on Wednesday as police and SIU officials conducted an investigation. A helicopter hovered overhead for several hours. We were really drawn to this Amber Alert because Crystal Beach is so close to home, and then this is even closer to home, said 16-year-old A.N. Meyer secondary school student Isabella Puglia, who happened across the Niagara Falls scene with her 16-year-old friend and Meyer colleague Brooklyn Campbell. My family sent an article in a group chat, and we were like, oh my God, this is why that street is closed, Campbell said. A man who lives in the area said he went to the scene after hearing the helicopter. When a helicopter is circling for 2 hours, something's going on, the man said, who did not want to be identified. During a news conference near the scene Wednesday, Danette said SIU investigators are collecting evidence and interviewing witnesses. They're also collecting any potential video surveillance to paint a picture of what happened. She said what precipitated the shooting is that the SIU is investigating. Five SIU investigators and two forensic investigators have been assigned to the case. There was a firearm that was recovered at the scene that belonged to the male individual. But as far as what happened prior to the police firing the weapon on, that's what we're investigating. Danette said the SIU doesn't have any information about whether the suspect fired his gun. At this time, I understand one officer discharged the firearm, she said, adding an autopsy of the suspect was scheduled for Thursday. During the news conference, the NRP's Hingley said shortly after the Amber Alert was issued, officers received information that the child was found safe in Niagara. However, the male suspect was outstanding. We received evidence that took us to Crystal Beach, and based on that evidence, a shelter in place was put in, he said. That was to ensure not only the public safety, but the safety of our officers while they were looking for the subject, who was believed to be armed at the time as a result of the Peel information. Hingley said the suspect left the area during the evening and police received information he was in the Niagara Falls area. The timeline was roughly 2 hours, 2.5 hours, between the time that the child was reported safe and the time that we gained some evidence of the possible whereabouts of the suspect. He said police are still trying to establish the relationship between the suspect and the child. The Toronto Star reported the man was the child's father, as identified in the Amber Alert. Hingley said police also still don't know the relationship between the suspect and the woman who was driving the vehicle. She is in our custody right now. Charges are pending, Hingley said, adding those charges would be related to accessory and abetting. DeShepherd was first wanted by Peel police after a woman was shot in the parking lot of a plaza in Brampton. Police have not named the victim, but in multiple social media posts, she has been identified as a 29-year-old Brampton mother of four young children, including the toddler who was the subject of the Amber Alert. We want to thank our partners at Niagara Regional Police for their collaboration and support during the investigation, Peel Police said in a post on X. Our thoughts remain with the family and loved ones of the victim during this incredibly difficult time. DeShepherd had been scheduled to stand trial on multiple charges in Brampton in March 2026. The SIU asked anyone who may have information about the investigation, including video or photos, to contact the lead investigator at 1-800-787-8529. Turning to the local section of the Niagara Falls Review for October 23rd, Cisco says speed cameras are the right investment. Karenna Walter. When it comes to supporting speed cameras in Niagara, the goal isn't making money, it's slowing traffic, St. Catharines Mayor Matt Cisco says. Cisco was speaking to listeners in a live telephone town hall session about the city budget Tuesday night and said all the dollars the municipality gets from speed cameras fines go into traffic calming measures such as speed humps or lane narrowing. Ultimately, the only goal is to slow the traffic down, but when we do collect revenue, that revenue doesn't just go in general coffers. We are using it to build up the roads so that they slow the traffic down as well, he said, answering a listener's questions about the speed camera program. And I think that should ultimately be the goal for everybody. Premier Doug Ford has called the cameras used by municipalities a cash grab and tabled legislation on Monday to ban them. Cisco was one of 22 mayors who signed a letter earlier this month asking Ford not to take away the cameras, but instead help improve their use with changes. Those included limiting use to school days, giving warning tickets for the first offenses, and ensuring people can't get fined repeatedly when a new camera is set up. On Tuesday, Ontario's big city mayors, of which Cisco is a member, sent forward a similar request. I think speed cameras are the right investment, Cisco told the town hall listeners, adding he knows they frustrate people and said changes were proposed by the mayors because they recognize concerns. In St. Catharines and Niagara, the program's been pretty much well run. If you go outside of St. Catharines and Niagara, some municipalities have definitely been abusing the speed camera program. Niagara isn't one of them. Niagara Region's speed cameras made approximately $3 million in revenue in 2024 after deducting operating costs. Half of the money, $1.5 million, was shared proportionately with the region's 12 lower-tier municipalities based on assessment value. Cisco said if people drive across St. Catharines, they'll start to see how the money has been used on city and regional roads. In Porta Luce, traffic calming measures were added on Main Street in front of an elementary school, which he said are working. Traffic calming measures involving plastic delineator poles were added on Oakdale Crescent in Meriton after residents coming off a side street raised concerns about speeders. There was traffic coming along Oakdale at very high rates of speed, and it was making it, on some parts of the day, almost impossible to turn out of there with any security that you weren't going to get T-boned by somebody coming around a bit of a blind corner, Sisko said. We put in traffic calming measures, and it slowed traffic down enough that the residents now can feel comfortable. They can make left or right and turn out of that court without any issue, but the traffic is still moving. So that's what we use the speed cameras for. You're listening to a reading of articles and features from the Niagara Falls Review on the Niagara Frontier Radio Reading Service. Continuing with the local section of the Niagara Falls Review for October 23rd, Sleep Cheap Charities REAP opened today. Metroland staff. Get your dialing finger ready. It's the time of year again when Niagara residents are offered discounted hotel stays in the heart of the Niagara Falls Tourist District. Sleep Cheap Charities REAP returns November 23rd to the 27th and offers discounted rates for accommodation at participating Niagara Falls hotels, with all proceeds going to worthy causes. Now in its 22nd year, the program has raised more than $2.6 million for nearly 100 different charities since its inception in 2004. The program is available exclusively for Niagara residents. Donations for rooms are $65 per night for a standard room, $75 for a Falls View or Whirlpool room, and $125 for a water park room. Participants can book up to two night stays. The charitable application process is also open for local charities and registered not-for-profits interested in receiving donations from the program. Reservations can be made starting 9 a.m. on Thursday. Participating hotels and booking information can be found at sleepcheapcharitiesreap.com. The event was initiated in 2004 by Mayor Jim Diodati, then a city councilor, to celebrate the city's 100th anniversary and to promote goodwill between the tourist industry and residents. It has been organized for roughly the past decade by Niagara Falls City Council Victor Pietranel. Coinciding with the event is the Wonder Falls Pass, which offers discounted admission to various local attractions. Details of the pass will be released at a later date. Continuing with the Niagara Falls Review for October 23rd in local news, Fort Erie joins call for public list of sex offenders. The town of Fort Erie is joining a handful of other Niagara municipalities in urging upper levels of government to make registries of sex offenders public information. A motion approved by Thorold City Councilors was on Fort Erie's regular council agenda Monday night, one that urges the province to open the list for Ontarians to see. Following a motion brought forward by Ward 1 Councilman George McDermott, Thorold's resolution was supported, with Fort Erie also adding that the federal government be urged to do the same with the National Registry. McDermott's motion was approved unanimously. The National Registry was created in 2004 to provide police with access to current and reliable information on registered sex offenders, in order to help police prevent or investigate sexual offenses. Ontario's registry was created 3 years earlier, following the passing of Christopher's Law in 2000. Councilors considered the motion after a presentation made by Niagara residents Stephen Seuss and Alicia Gugu, who said support has also been received by Waynefleet, Lincoln, Grimsey, St. Catharines, and Niagara Falls. Gugu shared her personal story, telling council and staff she is a survivor of childhood sexual abuse. She said her abuser was listed on the registry, and had it been accessible, what happened to her could have been prevented. She said many survivors carry invisible wounds and that they often think no one will believe them if they come out with their story. This isn't a political debate, said Gugu. It's a moral responsibility. The presenters also said the sexual assault of a Welland toddler during an August break-in is an example of why a list of sex offenders needs to be made public. Seuss said only police organizations are permitted access to sexual offender lists. Mayor Wayne Redekop also asked the presenters what they believe is the reason for this. Gugu said she attributes much of it to fear of vigilantism, people taking matters into their own hands and choosing threats and violence against individuals who are on the list. In supporting Thorold's resolution, Fort Erie Council recommended forwarding it to the Prime Minister, Association of Municipalities of Ontario, Federation of Canadian Municipalities, and the Federal Minister of Justice. Turning to the opinions for the October 23 Niagara Falls Review. Blame Outdated Economic Models for This Mess by Susan Cajuan. We are doing a disastrous job of living within our means. In a remarkably short time, we have mined, clear-cut, paved over, and heated up our planet while decimating populations of other creatures. We have stretched Earth beyond its ability to regenerate from our endless assault on multiple ecosystems. Our warm water coral reefs may never recover because of rising ocean temperatures, the Global Tipping Points Report 2025 states. Melting ice sheets at both poles are running a close second behind the reefs and having deadly impacts worldwide. Outdated economic models are largely responsible for this mess. We need to embrace a new economic model to get us out of it. The wheel revolutionized human society. Now it's time for the donut. British economist Kate Raworth developed the donut economy model as a template for 21st century economics. It clearly and cleverly illustrates the goal of meeting the needs of all people within the means of the living planet. We cannot continue to prioritize the virtual economic fires created by the United States while Canada's North literally burns. If you're not familiar with this model, picture the classic donut with a hole shape. The outer edge represents the limits of what Earth can provide. The inside edge shows the social foundation of life's essentials, such as health, food, and education. The donut itself is the safe and just space for humanity. With a regenerative and distributive economy, the Donut Economics Action Lab has a free guide in four languages for local governments that includes 12 case studies. Canadian governments are woefully missing engagement with the donut outside of Toronto and a few locations in British Columbia. Since Raworth published Donut Economics in 2012, she has updated the model to reflect our changing reality. The new peer-reviewed analysis last month in Nature shows that the richest 20% of nations, with 15% of the global population, contribute more than 40% of annual ecological overshoot, whereas the poorest 40% of countries, with 42% of the global population, experience more than 60% of the social shortfall. As MP Elizabeth May recently wrote, we need the brainy and thoughtful Mark Carney, who warned of climate change, back. These are seven ways he can think and lead like a 21st century economist. Change the goal from GDP to the donut. Embed the economy within our environment rather than as a self-contained entity. See humans as social and adaptable, not rational economic bodies. Embrace dynamic complexity, not the mechanical equilibrium of supply and demand. Designed to distribute because growth does not even it up again. Create to regenerate rather than expect growth to clean it up. Be agnostic rather than addicted to growth. Time is running out. Canada must double down on the cascade effect of collapsing ecosystem functions. Our tipping points must tip towards restoring a livable climate so we can all thrive in the sweet spot of the donut. Susan Koshwin is a freelance contributing columnist for the Waterloo Region Record. Letters to the editor from the October 23rd Niagara Falls Review. Shared Services, a feel-good headline. Niagara CAO's loud shared services procurement efforts, October 20th. Some of Niagara's municipal chief administrative officers gathered at regional headquarters to discuss a shared services initiative. The article mentions examples of shared services at the local level, including firefighting, libraries, and coordination of animal control. Across Niagara, shared services has become the new political buzzword, but it's mostly talk, not transformation. Local leaders say joint service delivery will cut costs and reduce duplication. Yet our municipalities still operate in silos, each protecting its own budget, staff, and political turf. Collaboration sounds good until someone has to give up control. One has only to look at Niagara Falls' plan to transfer fire dispatch to St. Catharines. That's already tied up in union challenges and arbitration. Even if it happens, both cities will still have their own fire departments and layers of administration. Look at Lincoln Grimsey's Shared Fire Services pilot. It has been recognized and praised for innovation, but both towns have their own councils, budgets, and bureaucracies. After several years, both fire services will go back to business as usual. Shared services don't cut Niagara's 126 politicians or simplify government. They often create extra meetings, agreements, and bureaucracy. Lower-tier municipalities will continue to do what is best for themselves, even at the expense of other municipalities or Niagara region. Look at the economic development or physician recruitment as examples. As we see increasing numbers of local residents falling into property tax arrears, it is clear the current government structure is not working. If Niagara really wants efficiency, we need real governance reform, not half measures that keep every local empire intact. With 12 municipalities and 12 councils serving 500,000 residents, it's time to ask if this structure still makes sense. Until we face that reality, shared services will remain little more than a feel-good headline. Alan McKay, St. Catharines. The next letter to the editor. Guns are the problem. Five Hamiltonians arrested, guns and drugs seized in relation to Grimsby shooting October 18th. U.S. President Donald Trump has falsely accused Canada of being a major source of illegal immigrants and fentanyl. However, the real problem is American guns and accessories. Conservatives love mandatory minimum sentences, so let's give them something to chew on. Let's introduce mandatory minimum sentences for anyone smuggling firearms, banned weapons, or add-ons. I suggest American-style sentencing of 7 years per count. For example, two handguns and an oversized magazine would get 21 years and no bail. The U.S. and its lust for guns is horrifying. Mass shootings occur almost daily. The belief that more guns make people safer is sick. If the sentences don't stop American guns from entering Canada, make sentences even stiffer. Put the gun runners in cells with child abusers. They both cause harm to young people. Russ Young, Fort Erie. You are listening to a reading of articles and features from the Niagara Falls Review on the Niagara Frontier Radio Reading Service. Continuing with the Niagara Falls Review for October 23rd, the Ontario section. Clock ticks towards childcare deal expiry. Allison Jones. Ontario's deal with the federal government to operate a $10 a day childcare system in the province is set to expire in 5 months, but there has been little apparent progress in extension negotiations, which has some advocates, operators, and parents calling for certainty. Most provinces and territories signed extensions with the federal government before this year's federal election, but Ontario only signed an agreement in principle to continue the program, which is set to expire on March 31st. Education Minister Paul Calandra said the federal government needs to address a shortfall of $2 billion per year that would occur if the current funding structure is left in place. But first, Ottawa needs to come to the table. We are unfortunately in a bit of a holding pattern right now as we wait for the federal government to come to the table with respect to the next 5 years of the program, Calandra said during question period. We have been begging the federal government to come to the table so that we can begin talking about an extension of the child care program. We have sent letters to the federal government. We have called the federal government. We understand that the new minister does not yet have a mandate from her Treasury board to begin negotiations with us. It is hard to negotiate with yourself at the table. We want an extension of the program. Parent fees at Ontario daycare centers in the program were cut by more than 50% on average and are now currently capped at $22 a day as an interim step towards the $10 a day mark. However, Calandra has warned that if the province is unable to secure a new agreement with the federal government, costs would rise for families come April 1st. A spokesperson for Federal Families Minister Patty Hajdu said negotiations are being resumed with provinces and territories. We are focused on working with them to lower costs for family and build a more affordable Canada, Jennifer Kozlik said in a statement. Janet Amito, a single mother, said Tuesday at a news conference with the Ontario Coalition for Better Child Care that she is counting on politicians to uphold their promises to deliver affordable child care. If the $10 a day expires and fees go up, it will not be feasible for me to pay for child care for my son, she said. I would not be able to work, but then how would I pay my bills? Child care is one of the only costs that has gone down recently. Housing, food, and everything else is so expensive. Affordable child care helps my family make ends meet. Without it, I'm not sure that what we would do. Carolyn Ferns, a policy coordinator with the Child Care Coalition, said it doesn't seem like a priority for either government right now, which is troubling. When we reached the agreement in principle, everyone felt like, oh, it'll probably get sorted out, she said. You know, that'll happen. And then the months tick by, and it didn't happen. But there's still a feeling out there that it'll be fine, that the federal government won't let Ontario go, and Ontario wouldn't let this happen. But I'm increasingly worried that we actually could lose it. Andrea Hannon, executive director of the Association of Daycare Operators of Ontario, said the members she has spoken to don't believe the government will let the program lapse, as it has been so popular with families. But they also don't really expect certainty in a timely fashion, she said. Yes, it's a short time frame, but nothing in the way this program has been implemented has ever been done to allow child care owner operators to plan their operations for the coming year, Hannon said in an interview. It's all been fly by the seat of the pants and kind of random. Sometimes people don't know what their funding allocation for the coming year is until April, in the middle of that year. So I don't think anybody expects there to be any predictability or sanity. Child care operator Sheila Olin-McLean said she tells her center's family that the next year's fees will be in December, which is quickly approaching. I think it will be quite shocking for families if by December 1st, if there's no deal, she said in an interview. Then we have to send out to families that this could be your fee for the next year. If we have the $10 a day program, it would be less than $22 a day, or it could be close to $100 a day without the program. As well, the program provides wage increases for early childhood educators, so if the government lets the program expire, her center's educators will lose $4 an hour, she said. Child care operators have said one of the biggest challenges in creating new spaces and maintaining existing ones is staff shortages. And a recent report by Ontario's Auditor General said the province will need 10,000 more ECE by the next year. A federal Auditor General report on Tuesday found that the program has so far been successful in reducing fees, but is behind on space creation and other goals. Turning to the Canada and World section of the October 23rd Niagara Falls Review. Special blessing. India's envoy disputes claim that Audia. India's envoy disputes claim that Ottawa can fully staff its embassy, by Dylan Robinson. India's new envoy to Canada rejected Foreign Minister Anita Anand's claim that the New Delhi has agreed to restore Canada's full complement of diplomats. Indian High Commissioner Dinesh Patnaik said Ottawa must first resolve delays in accrediting his diplomatic staff in Canada. It's a reciprocal trust, Patnaik told the Canadian press in an interview last Thursday. Trust has to be built up on both sides. His comments come as the Carney government pursues a reset of its relations with India, 2 years after Ottawa accused New Delhi of playing a role in assassinating a Sikh activist near Vancouver, and 1 year after the RCMP accused the Indian government of involvement in homicides and acts of extortion and coercion in Canada. Ottawa removed most of its diplomats from India in October 2023, after New Delhi threatened to strip diplomatic immunity from 41 Canadian officials and their 42 dependents. Along with diplomats, Ottawa had experts in fields like defense and agriculture working in India at the time. Foreign Affairs Minister Anita Anand visited India earlier this month, and both countries released a joint statement pledging a stronger partnership. Anand told reporters at the end of her visit that New Delhi would allow for the return of Canada's full cohort of diplomats, though that wasn't mentioned in the joint statement. She said Ottawa would not consider reopening trade talks until India takes the step. We both agreed that we would staff up as we had been before in order to service our respective populations, she said on October 14th. Patnaik said India has never agreed to allow Ottawa to fully staff up. We have agreed to a certain movement forward in starting to get the number of people necessary for diplomatic missions to function effectively, he said in the October 16th interview. We want to make sure that it's easy for each of our people to get visas to come and function as diplomats. Numbers are not important. It's the ease of doing things which is more important. Patnaik said that hinges on India being able to bring experts to Canada on diplomatic passports. Continuing with the Canada and World section, National Briefs, errors found in AI chatbot news. A report from public broadcasters say AI chatbots make mistakes with news content nearly half of the time. The study, which looked at how AI chatbots answer questions about news and current affairs, involved 22 public media organizations in 18 countries, including CBC/Radio Canada. Their journalists evaluated more than 3,000 responses provided by four chatbots: OpenAI's ChatGPT, Microsoft's Copilot, Google's Gemini, and Perplexity. They say they found at least one significant problem with 45% of the AI answers. From British Columbia, party leader won't quit. British Columbia Conservative leader John Rustad says he will not resign after the party's president and other members of its management committee told him to quit over chaos in the official opposition ranks. The committee members say in a letter to Rustad that turmoil under his leadership has undermined the party's credibility. Rustad told reporters that the letter was an internal matter within the party, and he plans to have an opportunity to speak with the management committee. Alberta, lightning blamed for fire. Two reports on last year's wildfire in Jasper confirm the blaze was caused by lightning and accelerated by tornado force fire-generated winds and dry conditions. The fire hit town 2 days after starting and destroyed a third of the community's structures in July 2024. It forced 25,000 residents and visitors to flee and displaced an estimated 2,000 people. Turning to the business section of the October 23rd Niagara Falls Review. Hearings on changes to Canada Post begin. By Estella Wren. The federal minister who oversees Canada Post will face a committee of his peers to answer questions about his decision to push ahead with sweeping changes to the post office and the ongoing labor strife between the Crown Corporation and the union and its union. Joel Lightbound, Minister for Government Transformation, Public Works, and Procurement, is set to testify before the Standing Committee on Government Operations and Estimates on Thursday afternoon in Ottawa as it kicks off a series of hearings into the government's directive to Canada Post to overhaul its operations. The government cannot be permitted to make such drastic decisions when there has been next to no public consultation on the issues and while collective agreement bargaining remains unfinished, said Jan Simpson, the national president of the Canadian Union of Postal Workers, in a statement. The hearings come after talks between the postal workers and Lightbound ended on a sour note last week when the minister refused to cede any ground to the union, which is trying to convince the feds to put the brakes on its plans. The union is in its second week of rotating strikes, which were launched October 10th at the heels of a nationwide strike. Ariane Reza and Lorenzo Iracci, Deputy Minister and Assistant Deputy Minister, respectively, at the Department of Public Works and Government Services, are also scheduled to address the committee on Thursday. They will be followed by individual witnesses, including business professors Ian Lee and Marvin Ryder and Karen Monger, Chief Executive Officer of the Quebec Regional Municipality of MRC du Golfe-du-Saint-Laurent. CUPW and Canada Post did not respond to the Star's request for comments by the time of publication. Lee, an associate professor at Carleton University's Sprott School of Business, told the Star that the House of Commons committee invited him to speak and he said he plans to back Canada Post's shakeup to stop it from bleeding money, including cutting door-to-door delivery for about a quarter of Canadians. Lee said he thinks the Standing Committee is trying to investigate if there is a compromise position where Canada Post can be slimmed down, made financially sustainable, and still serve key communities. Stephen Tufts, a York University Labor Studies professor, said he believes nothing drastically new will come out of the hearings that will change the government's mind. You are listening to a reading of articles and features from the Niagara Falls Review on the Niagara Frontier Radio Reading Service. Continuing with the October 23rd Niagara Falls Review from the business section. Bay workers want pension surplus. By Tara Descamps. Some former Hudson Bay employees have filed a class action lawsuit seeking a share of the defunct retailer's pension surplus. The court filing was made on behalf of workers who were enrolled in a pension plan offered by Simpsons, a rival department store HBC bought in the 1970s. The takeover made HBC the administrator of the Simpsons pension plan, which had a surplus at the time. The court filing does not say how big the surplus was when the acquisition happened, but says annual pension statement reports HBC sent Simpson workers showed that as of January 1, 2024, there was about $167.03 million in a trust fund linked to HBC's overall plan. Any surplus the company has stands to become a flashpoint in HBC's ongoing creditor protection case because lawyers have expressed doubt that the retailer will be able to repay the $1.1 billion it owed creditors when it collapsed. The debt caused the business, once Canada's oldest company, to close all of its stores over the summer, ending jobs for about 9,300 people. HBC declined to comment on the class action lawsuit, which was filed in June but flew under the radar until a judge in its creditor protection case mentioned it at a hearing earlier this week. The class action was filed by employment law firm Kosky Minsky LLP and names TELUS and RBC Investment as respondents. TELUS was appointed in April as the HBC Pension Plan Administrator by the Financial Services Regulatory Authority of Ontario. RBC holds the assets of the plan. The court filing making the case for Simpsons workers to get a share of any surplus left offers a peek at how HBC's growth shaped its pension plans, but also pitted some staff against each other. The document says HBC added Zellers employees to the Simpsons plan in 1994 and then Kmart staff in 1998. Between 1994 and 2006, court documents filed by Kosky Minsky in HBC's creditor protection case show HBC used about $111 million of the surplus assets originating from the Simpsons pension plan to cover defined contribution pension costs for Zellers and Kmart employees. The moves angered former Simpsons employees who sued HBC to stop their surplus funding being used for the staff who had been rolled into the plan more recently. The judge in that case ruled HBC could use the Simpsons pension plan surplus to pay its obligations to the broader defined contribution group while the plan remained active. However, he said if the plan is ever wound down, former Simpsons employees are entitled to the surplus assets in the plan, if there are any remaining. HBC appealed several parts of the ruling, including a portion that ruled it wouldn't be entitled to surplus assets. The Ontario Court of Appeal dismissed HBC's cross appeal, and the Supreme Court of Canada would not hear the case. Workers enrolled in the Simpsons plan now say they are entitled to that surplus because of the judge's prior ruling. When the class action was first filed, Kosky Minsky said the Financial Services Regulatory Authority of Ontario reported HBC's pension plan had 4,976 active members and about $460.07 million. And returning to the local section of the October 23rd Niagara Falls Review, St. Catharines man dead after six-vehicle crash on Highway 406. A 32-year-old St. Catharines man has died after a six-vehicle collision on Highway 406 in Thorold. The highway has been closed in both directions between Beaver Dams and St. David's Roads. In a post on X, Burlington, Ontario Provincial Police Media Officer Constable Rob Tehor said The collision occurred at about 6:45 a.m. when a southbound vehicle traveled into the northbound lanes for an unknown reason. The driver of that vehicle was the person who died, Theor said. He said other people involved in the collision reported minor injuries. The highway is expected to remain closed until at least 5 p.m. Continuing with the local section, Marineland says Nova Scotia refuge not viable for its beluga whales, by Allison Langley. Marineland says a planned coastal refuge for captive whales recently greenlighted by the Nova Scotia government is an inappropriate facility for its beluga whales. The U.S.-based Whale Sanctuary Project announced this week Nova Scotia Premier Tim Houston's cabinet had granted the organization a 20-year lease for 83 hectares of crown lands and coastal waters on the province's eastern shore. Project organizers said the approval means they can start building a huge floating net enclosure for whales and dolphins retired from marine theme parks like Marineland in Niagara Falls. But in a statement Wednesday, Marineland said the project is not a suitable option for its 30 belugas. Marineland has provided reports to everyone, the government and press, that sets out very serious issues of concern that need to be addressed, which makes Whale Sanctuary Project a non-viable alternative at this time. Marineland released a report previously saying it had many reasons why none of Canada's last remaining captive whales should be sent to the Nova Scotia site. The report alleged the site is too polluted and has seen no development since plans for its construction were unveiled in 2020. Charles Vinnick, the project's executive director, has dismissed the report, saying his group has completed extensive environmental testing and has won approval for plans to contain the mess left behind by the gold mining industry. In an emailed statement, project spokesperson Caroline Saxon said Wednesday the Nova Scotia government's decision means the project now has a clear path to begin construction and to raise the capital funds to complete the sanctuary. The project is estimated to cost about $20 million and will require about $2 million annually to operate. Marineland made headlines earlier this month when Ottawa rejected its bid to sell its belugas to a theme park in China. The beleaguered theme park responded by saying it might have to euthanize its whales because it didn't have enough money to feed them. About the same time, Nunavik Man urged Inuit leaders to step in and help provide habitat for the belugas, suggesting they could be released in Hudson Bay, Ungava Bay, or the St. Lawrence River. Marineland has said previously the belugas have lost the capacity to survive in the wild and cannot adapt to the demands of natural ecosystems. Meanwhile, Whale Sanctuary Project said the refuge could open as early as next year, but no marine mammals will be moved to the site until the project receives permits from the Federal Fisheries Department and Transport Canada. And continuing with the local news of the October 23rd Niagara Falls Review, remains at park, those of South Asian woman. Human remains found in Charles Daly Park in Lincoln Tuesday are being treated by police as a suspicious death case. Niagara Regional Police were called to the Lake Ontario Waterfront Park at about 11 a.m. Just before noon Tuesday, police posted a map on social media outlining the park just west of 7th Street, Louth, in St. Catharines, advising people to stay clear. Later Tuesday, police sent out an update saying the remains belonged to a woman believed to be between 25 and 40 years old. She is described as being about 5'4", weighing 130 to 150 pounds, with long, dark, curly hair. She is believed to be of South Asian descent. The woman was wearing a pink zip-up hoodie with a Playboy logo, light blue jeans, a black shirt, gray socks, and gold hoop earrings. Police are asking anyone who went to the park in the 24 hours prior to 11 a.m. Tuesday to contact them. At this time, police do not know the relationship between the victim and the as-yet unidentified suspect or suspects. Because of this, police said investigators cannot confirm whether the incident was random or targeted. Police are urging the public to remain vigilant and to contact them with any information which may assist the investigation. Anyone with information can call police at 905-688-4111, option 3, extension 1009451. Information can be submitted anonymously by calling Crime Stoppers at 1-800-222-8477 or going to crimestoppers-niagara.ca. You've been listening to a reading of articles and features from current issues of the Niagara Falls Review. We read from the Niagara Falls Review every Sunday at 6 p.m. Your reader has been Patricia. Thank you for listening.